Following are comments on Shakespeare's Hamlet, Act I. First, some preliminary observations on the play. Theology. In Christian terms, revenge usurps God's prerogatives, but this understanding clashes with what we find in classical literature. In Aeschylus's trilogy, The Oresteia, Orestes would be wrong not to take vengeance for Agamemnon's murder. The Elizabethans loved Senecan revenge tragedy, as Thomas Kyd's The Spanish Tragedy shows. But in Hamlet, Shakespeare faces most squarely the Christian revenger's theological dilemma as he goes about avenging his father's killing. Skepticism. There is something to the idea, as aired in T.S. Eliot's 1919 essay, Hamlet and His Problems, that Hamlet is not fit to be a tragic hero. We can say only half in jest that the prince's problem is he has read too many of Montaigne's skeptical essays. Early in the play, all Hamlet has to go on is that a purgatorial ghost tells him what he wants to hear. Uncle Claudius is stealing Gertrude's attention and her son's kingdom. Recognition. When does Hamlet attain clarity about the nature of his actions? He has come round to the idea that he needs to let things shape up as they may. Assuming that he's in earnest and not deceiving himself, when, in Act 5, Scene 2, he makes his remarks about, quote-unquote, a special providence in the fall of a sparrow, how did he get to that point? Perhaps Hamlet's realization stems from experiencing the shock of Ophelia's death. Perhaps it owes something to meditating on a foreign army going to its death, even for an eggshell, quote-unquote. Or bantering with a gravedigger and meditating on Yorick's skull. Maybe it involves his reaction to escaping from the ship taking him to his death in England, and then being ransomed by pirates. How about Hamlet's experiencing conflicted feelings with respect to Ophelia and Gertrude? Then, too, the prince is a young man with his whole life ahead of him, yet compelled to give his life for his dead father's honor. Could it be some combination of all these things? If so, Hamlet is one complicated revenger. In the Poetics, Aristotle says that well-crafted tragedies turn upon the hero's arriving at some insight, anagnorisis, recognition, about his or her mistake. What is Hamlet's insight, and what has led him to it? What makes the play's resolution possible? Is it that Hamlet has been unable to act and something now makes him able? Or should we account for the conclusion differently? Proto-romantic subjectivity. In his set of Shakespeare commentaries, Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human, Riverhead Books, 1998, Harold Bloom writes that Hamlet, thanks to his intense interiority and complexity, overflows the revenge tragedy that hosts him. Bloom's notion resembles the Romantic era conception of the Prince of Denmark as a man, quote-unquote, out of joint with and superior to the action hero task handed to him by his father's ghost. That isn't the only way we can interpret Hamlet as a character, but it's a compelling reading. Moving on to Act I. This spirit, dumb to us, will speak to him. A ghost who perfectly resembles Hamlet's dead father appears to Marcellus and Barnardo, as well as to Hamlet's skeptical friend Horatio. In Act I, Scene 1, Barnardo and Francisco await the changing of their watch at Elsinore Castle, and Marcellus shows up. He and Barnardo have seen a strange apparition twice, so he has invited Hamlet's friend Horatio to watch with them tonight. Horatio remains dubious and, quote-unquote, will not let belief take hold of him. Act 1, Scene 1, Line 23. A third sighting materializes, looking just like the late King Hamlet Sr. Even Horatio is a believer now, though the ghost has nothing to say to him. The ghost was dressed in full battle armor, so Horatio offers a plausible conjecture. he suspects the apparition's presence, quote-unquote, bodes some strange eruption to our state, meaning that the ghost intends to issue a security warning. Act 1, Scene 1, line 68. After all, young Fortinbras is planning to take back territory his father had lost to Hamlet Sr. Bernardo supposes much the same, saying, quote-unquote, "Well may it sort that this portentous figure comes armed through our watch, so like the king that was and is the question of these wars." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 108 through 110. These men's surmises are plausible, but they do not accurately address the ghost's purpose. "'Tis common, all that lives must die." The new king, Claudius, and his queen, Gertrude, hold court and try to cheer up the brooding Prince Hamlet, who still mourns for his father, King Hamlet. In Act 1, Scene 2, the new king, Claudius, has married his sister-in-law, Gertrude, after the death of his brother, King Hamlet Sr. Claudius is a smooth, skillful speaker, but betrays a schizoid sense of his own actions. He has married Gertrude, so recently his sister-in-law, quote-unquote, "with a defeated joy," and, quote-unquote, "with an auspicious and a dropping eye." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 10 through 11. Claudius sends Cornelius and Voltimand as ambassadors to Old Norway, uncle of young Fortinbras, and assents to Polonius's request that his son Laertes be allowed to return to France. The king then rounds upon Hamlet and asks, quote-unquote, "How is it that the clouds still hang on you?" Act 1, Scene 2, line 66. Hamlet's grief seems to the royal couple impolitic, self-indulgent, and prideful. Gertrude says to Hamlet, quote-unquote, "Do not forever with thy veiled lids seek for thy noble father in the dust. Thou knowest, 'tis common, all that lives must die." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 70 through 72. This is expected and probably even sound advice on the part of concerned medieval parents. What today we would consider premature death was all too common back then. But Hamlet's response already shows signs of the intense interiority that will cause him so much inner conflict later in the play. He tells his mother Gertrude, quote-unquote, "I have that within which passes show, these but the trappings and the suits of woe." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 85 through 86. Soon Hamlet speaks his first soliloquy, beginning, quote-unquote, "Oh, that this too sallied flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 129 through 130. He laments that God has already, quote-unquote, "fixed his canon against self-slaughter." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 131 through 132. He also reproaches women in the person of Gertrude, quote-unquote, "frailty, thy name is woman." Act 1, Scene 2, line 146. In case that isn't reason enough for his depression, Hamlet reveals how much disdain he feels for his uncle Claudius, especially in comparison with Hamlet Sr. The latter, he says, was the Titan Hyperion, father of the sun god Helios, compared to Claudius's animalistic satyr. Act 1, Scene 2, line 140. Hamlet morbidly sees the whole world as, quote-unquote, "an unweeded garden that grows to seed, one inhabited by, quote-unquote, things rank and gross in nature." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 135 through 136. He is already obsessed with the dark intimation that people are not what they seem. They almost never are, in truth, and that's particularly true in the treacherous, courtly environments Shakespeare so often portrays, as he does here in Denmark's Elsinore Castle. To borrow a line from Horatio, quote-unquote, "there needs no ghost, my lord, come from the grave to tell us this." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 127 through 128. In any case, Hamlet knows he must repress this feeling in public, quote unquote, but break my heart, for I must hold my tongue. Act 1, Scene 2, line 159. Like others in this courtly environment, he has been brought up to understand that he is a public man. Privately, he already suspects that, quote unquote, some foul play was involved in his father's death. Act 1, Scene 2, line 255. The prince's scene-ending thought is, quote unquote, foul deeds will rise, though all the earth o'erwhelm them to men's eyes. Act 1, Scene 2, lines 256 through 257. Hamlet is about to receive his orders as a revenger, and his response will be anything but simple. But his intimation that a supernatural framework is about to usurp his private griefs is not wrong. To thine own self be true. Polonius fills France-bound Laertes with advice on conduct and morals, while Laertes and Polonius both lecture Ophelia about Hamlet's intentions and royal status. In Act 1, Scene 3, Laertes lectures his sister Ophelia about the dangers of romancing a man above her station. Act 1, Scene 3, lines 10 through 49 inclusive. This advice is sound as far as it goes, though it's rather cheeky of Laertes to mansplain the importance of chastity to a sister who is at least as mature as he is. Ironically, Queen Gertrude, as she later admits, had hoped the two lovers would in fact marry. The difference in rank never bothered her at all. Ophelia wittily holds her own against Laertes, chiding him with, quote unquote, do not, as some ungracious pastors do, show me the steep and thorny way to heaven, whiles a puffed and reckless libertine, himself the primrose path of dalliance, treads. Act 1, Scene 3, lines 46 through 49. This early display of poise and spirit only increases the pathos of Ophelia's eventual madness and death. Polonius offers the departing Laertes some conduct book-sounding advice, such as, quote-unquote, neither a borrower nor a lender be, Act 1, Scene 3, line 74. But his best advice is, quote-unquote, this above all to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man, Act 1, Scene 3, lines 77 through 79. How ironic to hear such advice spoken in a play where so many noble characters find it impractical to heed. Of course, as authors such as Walter Raleigh and Francis Bacon could inform us, such advice often arises in precisely the kind of environment that makes it impossible to follow. Polonius ends the scene by accusing Ophelia of being naive about Hamlet's intentions. Hamlet, he suggests, is a young, lusty royal bachelor, and is therefore not to be trusted. Act 1, Scene 3, lines 89 and following. The sum is, Polonius will not allow Ophelia to, quote-unquote, so slander any moment leisure as to give words or talk with the Lord Hamlet. Act 1, Scene 3, lines 132 through 133. Thou com'st in such a questionable shape that I will speak to thee. The ghost beckons Hamlet to follow him, and he follows. In Act 1, Scene 4, Hamlet discusses the court of Denmark's fondness for alcohol, declaring that his country is, quote-unquote, traduced and taxed of other nations for this weakness. Act 1, Scene 4, line 18. Hamlet is not certain what to think of the strange apparition that soon visits him when he joins the watchmen and Horatio. Quote unquote, what may this mean that thou dead corse, again in complete steel, revisits thus the glimpses of the moon? Act 1, Scene 4, lines 51 through 53. Still, he will follow the ghost and declares, quote unquote, thou com'st in such a questionable shape that I will speak to thee. I'll call thee Hamlet, King, Father, Royal Dane. Act 1, Scene 4, lines 43 through 45. Thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain. Hamlet listens intently to the ghost's story and vows revenge. In Act 1, Scene 5, the ghost reaffirms that he is Hamlet's father and then recounts in detail what happened to him. Hamlet's excited, quote-unquote, "Oh, my prophetic soul," suggests that he already suspected Claudius. Act 1, Scene 5, line 41. The terms the ghost uses resemble Hamlet's. Gertrude has married, quote-unquote, "a wretch whose natural gifts were poor to those of mine." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 51 through 52. The revenge command is clear, quote-unquote, "Let not the royal bed of Denmark be a couch for luxury and damned incest." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 82 through 83. But there is also the impossible demand, quote-unquote, "Taint not thy mind, nor let thy soul contrive against thy mother aught." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 85 through 86. Since ancient times, for example in Homer's Odyssey and Aeschylus's Oresteia trilogy, there has been a strong sense of blood pollution adhering to the act of revenge, something that calls for the strongest possible purification rituals after it's accomplished. Still, Hamlet seems convinced, for now, to be his father's revenger. Or at least that's how it seems. Near the beginning of the ghost's recounting, Hamlet proclaims that he wants his revenge to come on, quote-unquote, "wings as swift as meditation or the thoughts of love." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 29 through 31. But soon his metaphor shifts. Quote-unquote, "yea, from the table of my memory, I'll wipe all trivial fond records." Ellipsis. "And thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 98 through 99, and lines 102 through 103. Hamlet's scholarly metaphor aptly invokes something like the schoolboy's fearful, diligent conning of his Latin lessons in grammar school. In Shakespeare's time, the arts of memorization were much promoted, which may account for all those Elizabethan actors with phenomenal ability to remember their lines under pressure. At the same time, the context in which Hamlet generates this metaphor renders it slightly comical in that he speaks of writing at the instant when he seems most certain of his desire to act. Revengers may be stymied for a while, but they don't need a note about a revenge date on their calendars. When Hamlet returns, he swears his friends to secrecy and says, quote-unquote, "there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 168 through 169. He may need to, quote-unquote, "put an antic disposition on," but apparently his friends are expected to understand that underlying motives and circumstances make this necessary. Act 1, Scene 5, line 173. Hamlet's concluding words may be the most revealing ones in Act 1. They indicate that the prince's meeting with his ghostly father has both won his acceptance of the task laid upon him and reinforced an already strong world weariness. Quote unquote, "the time is out of joint. Oh, cursed spite that ever I was born to set it right." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 189 through 190. Do these words indicate indecisiveness or even resentment? It's hard to take Hamlet's utterance here as consonant with the initial desire to, quote-unquote, sweep to his revenge. From now on, Hamlet's alternating enthusiasm and lack of motivation will be a feature in the play, not a bug. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Tuesday, February 3rd, 2026. The foregoing material is copyright 2026 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition 4-volume genre-based format.